Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 242 for comics originally released on March 28th, 2012. Now, starting us off in DC Vertigo is The New Dead Wardians, number one. This is an 8-issue miniseries. DCBS had this as part of a bundle with Ferris number one, Saucer Country number one, and what was that other one?
Dominique Laveau Voodoo Child.
Yeah, that
I
one.
Believe.
So since it was a bundle, I figured I'd get all four. This and the Dominique one, I don't think I would have gotten otherwise. I thought this was interesting. I wasn't really expecting to like this comic. It's just the concept-wise, not the sort of thing I generally read. Like I said, I got it mainly because it was offered at an incredible price, so why not? And I found the issue very entertaining. You know, they did the bundle at DCBS for issues 2 and 3, so it's got another couple issues to keep me going, at which point I'm 3/8 of the way through the miniseries. I'm liking the first issue enough that it's like, yeah, I'll ride it out. There were a couple of things about this issue, though, that left me a little bit thinking it could have been done better. You know, it's set in, you know, in London and stuff, and in this reality, you know, people are not just regular people. But the terms, you know, vampire and zombie and stuff are never explicitly used here. The basic premise and status quo of this reality are obliquely implied and shown here, but not really clarified in this issue. So I think if you know the premise from the solicits, you're great. But if you don't, I could see where a reader might be a little confused in a couple of places. And even knowing that, there were a couple of things that I was still a little confused by. So while I think this was well done, I think it could have been, and frankly should have been a little bit clearer in the setup on some of this stuff. I don't think new readers would be so totally perplexed as to be completely befuddled and confused, but clearer storytelling in general I think would have helped in a few places. I mean, what were your thoughts on this?
I didn't have that challenge that you had. I actually enjoyed the fact that they were kind of oblique towards it because it made it different than other comics of this general ilk that I have read. Because I read a lot more of this kind of stuff than you do, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it kind of refreshing, especially since it's set back in the Edwardian England era. You know, that they don't use the term vampire and zombie, which were not in popular use back then. It kind of makes sense that they have different terms that they use, and I find that the terms that they are using made kind of an internal consistency type of sense. And, you know, I kind of picked up, without trying to spoil it for anybody, I mean, I picked up on the difference between the ruling class and the servant class pretty quickly, and when they're talking about the cure, I kind of caught on to what that was pretty quickly as well. So I thought it was a very refreshing take on kind of a type of story that I've seen a number of times. You know, it's vampires and zombies. You know, okay, well, we've seen that a number of times. How is this one going to be fresh? Well, I mean, you put it back in the Edwardian age. Okay, that in and of itself gives it a little bit of a head up, you know, because it's not modern times. But then just the language that they're using and the art style, which is very different from, you know, standard, not, I'll say different from standard comic book art, not very different, but it gives it a unique feel that I think meshes well with the time era that it's set in the storytelling. I think it added some character to the story and made it also stand out in my mind. All these things blended together to make this be my favorite of the four new Vertigo books. between this and Ferris. I would probably put it this one first, Ferris second, Saucer Country third, and the Dominique Laveau one I will most likely drop when the bundle ends.
I guess for me is not having that deep of a background in the whole vampire and zombie lore and stuff. I'm still unclear what exactly they were referring to with the cure. There were a few things with the class aspect of society that still have me a little confused. This inspector has, you know, some servants and stuff, yet they don't appear to be, you know, anything other than regular people.
I think that's the... they're playing off, additional to the zombie and vampire thing, the very striated class structure of England, you know, back then also, where you had the servant classes and you had, you know, the, not necessarily nobles, but, you know, you had the wealthy people, and there was this huge gap between them. And it kind of makes sense the way that they're playing this. I thought that was really clever.
Well, I guess to me, it seems like there are three groups at play here. That upper class that, you know, like the inspector seems to fall into, the lower, you know, class with the B zone and all that stuff, and then this middle servant class almost that still seems to be the only real regular humans among the mix.
That's my exact reading also.
Okay. It just seemed to me confusing as to what would take somebody from there, that servant class, down into the, okay, you've got to get hauled away to the B zone. And why is it called the B zone? There are a couple of acronyms in a few places that were unclear.
I don't know where the B zone comes from. So that'll come in hopefully at some point. But you know, I think it's just like the servant. Well, we could talk about it after. I don't want to, again, spoilers.
I don't expect all of this to necessarily come out in a first issue. You know, it's an 8-part story, so I expect this over the 8 issues to clarify all these things. But there are a few things that I think a little bit more information in this issue would have helped give it a stronger start for me. I agree that the art really fit the material. It's got more of, again, a Vertigo kind of an art style than like a DCU kind of an art style. And it, like I said, it fit and it helped the story. I think ending it where they did on kind of the story beat they did made this feel a little bit more like just setup than I think it really is. Because I think while it is setting up the whole story, it's also a viable issue in and of itself. You know, it gave us enough progress in what's going on, who the characters are and stuff, that I didn't feel it was merely kind of like the teaser part of a TV episode or something.
Right.
But I could see where some people, particularly given how the issue ends, would come away with that sort of a feeling.
Yeah. Well, when we're done recording, I can give you a couple of things that I observed out of it, and it might be interesting to talk about. I really enjoyed this, though. It's definitely worth checking out, I think, if people have a chance to check this out in their comic shops. It is a very interesting and new take on the zombies and vampires. And, you know, Dan Abnett, not writing with Andy Lanning here, but I mean, he's a very talented writer. I mean, his work with Andy on, you know, Marvel's cosmic stuff and other things that those guys have done, I've been very, very entertained by in the past. So I was going into this kind of expecting, you know, that this would be good, and I wasn't disappointed. And he's a very talented writer.
Yeah. I would say it was one of the better of the four. For me, it's almost neck and neck with Saucer Country. I think Ferris did not have the strongest first issue it could have and should have had. But this is the one out of the bunch. I mean, if you're not already reading Fables, I don't know if you'd want to get into Ferris or not. But this is the one that I think would be the easiest to recommend to somebody if they're into, again, the zombie vampire type stuff. You know, and even if they're not, it's worth checking out. It's an interesting kind of a twist on that era of England.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a low 4. It was good. Certainly, I'm glad I checked it out because of the DCBS discount.
Yeah, for me, I'm going to give it 5. You know, my favorite one, and just there were a lot of just little subtle things that I think came off as maybe detractors for you that I actually thought were huge pluses for it, with some of the little twists and terminologies and ways, because I, I think I picked up on them, and they added to my enjoyment overall of the issue.
Cool.
Yeah, just really quickly on Ferrest, I think what my main thing there was, Ferrest seemed less like what I had been expecting out of it from the advertisements, which was, you know, Fables, but focusing on the female characters.
Yeah.
Because that first issue, it was like a Fable story, which is good, but it didn't have enough of a focus on a strong female lead. And that's what the weakness was in that issue, in my opinion.
I agree with that. They set up expectations for one thing, and the issue leaves off with us thinking, well, we'll finally get that next issue.
It should have opened very strongly on the female lead, you know, given how this series has been, you know, at least advertised and set up. And that kind of tracks, I think, with, you know, the different people that I've talked to about it, who like, well, I like Fables, but this one is like, you know, I wasn't that, you know, to me, it was just like another Fables comic. I like Fables, so I like Ferrest. You know, it's...
Well, and again, I agree with that, but they set expectations for one thing, and then in that issue, they live something different.
Exactly, and I agree with that, you know, that, which is, again, why it was a little down my list there.
Shall we move over to Marvel?
Sure. We've got a jumping on point, Avengers 24.1.
Now, this story takes place before Avengers versus X-Men number 0, which came out last week, and... The basic gist of this is it's kind of sort of kicking off the whole Avengers versus X-Men upcoming event slash fiasco, call it what you will. And the Vision has somehow magically managed to repair himself after having been ripped in half by She-Hulk way back in Avengers Disassembled storyline. It was actually Avengers 500, which came out back on July 28th, 2004. Now, that was the first Avengers issue written by Brian Michael Bendis. He's starting to get to the point where he's wrapping up his run. So, taking the things he did at the beginning and kind of putting the toys back how they need to be, I guess, for the next team. And, you know, we see him kind of face off with She-Hulk and Magneto as he comes to terms with, you know, kind of what's happened in the Marvel Universe over, really, what the last, you know, almost 8 years of you know, publishing stories. And all of this, of course, because of the Scarlet Witch. So it seems like she's going to be that focal thing between the Avengers and the X-Men. And it's funny, because I already read the Avengers vs. X-Men 0, and here he's looking for Scarlet Witch, and there he's already encountered her. And it's like, you know, publish these things out of order like that weakened this one a little bit, because I knew what was going to happen next, because I'd read it. And this did a decent job kind of jogging the memory of a few of the key events back from the Avengers Disassembled storyline, like, you know, what had happened to him, you know, who did it, and a few things like that. It doesn't cover all of that stuff, just what was relevant to the Vision. But I think where this issue for me was a missed opportunity was it could have done a much better job reintroducing the Vision to readers not familiar with him. I mean, he's been out of play since July 2004, for the most part. Newer readers might be confused by this version of the Vision because they could be more familiar with the Young Avengers version. So he's referred to here as, wow, he's this great Avenger. It's like, well, give us a couple of comments as to why. You know, really reintroduce him as if the readers who maybe come into the hobby since 2004 aren't that familiar with him. It looks like it does a decent job kind of springboarding into this, you know, epic Avengers versus X-Men conflict. And, you know, it certainly seems to imply that that conflict, you know, has been in the back of Brian Michael Bendis' head for a better part of a decade. So we'll see how all that pans out. And I thought this was okay. Very Vision-focused, but still had, you know, all of the Avengers. So it didn't feel like it was, you know, kind of shanghaiing an issue just for one character. Not that there would have been anything necessarily wrong with that. But there were a couple of things that did just seem to be a little bit out of the blue.
I like the Vision. He's one of my favorite Avengers, which is why I picked this up. Mm-hmm. I got the impression that it wasn't that the Vision's self-repair miraculously, you know, took over. Well, I mean, I got the impression
that's what Tony says.
Well, I think what he's saying is, and the way I read it was, Tony has been working on repairing Vision, and at some point he got him repaired to the point that his self-repair stuff finally was able to kick in and take it the rest of the way in the final way. So it's not like he was just sitting in a scrap heap somewhere and, you know, it just magically, you know.
And that's a perfectly viable reading of it. They left it ambiguous enough that who knows what happened.
Yeah. You know, so Tony's there in the lab with him. So that was the way I took it. So that didn't bother me. Mostly, since I have not been reading Avengers, you know, I kind of picked up on a lot of stuff that was happening. You got Hawkeye and Spider-Woman making out. I'm assuming that that's a relationship that's growing in Avengers. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that the Vision-Magneto confrontation was particularly well-written.
Well, it certainly doesn't set up the Vision as either being a tactical genius of any sort,
yeah,
or that big of a heavy hitter for the Avengers. So.
Yeah, you know, it's just I thought that was very poorly done, and the art in this issue really, really, it didn't hit me the right way. I mean, almost all of the faces seemed contorted and grimacing. It just, I had a major problem with the art in this issue. The art was, when Captain America comes in, just within a single panel, I mean a single page rather, it's like flipping back and forth between whether the artist is drawing the scale mail on Captain America's outfit or not. And it's like, you know, well, either draw the scale mail or don't draw the scale mail. Don't do it on one panel and then get lazy and don't draw it on the other panels. You know, it's just, it calls attention to itself when it's inconsistent there. I thought the art, for my taste, was severely underperforming in this issue. And it detracted from my enjoyment of the issue.
I can totally understand that. I mean, I didn't notice the scale mail thing while I was reading it, but, I mean, looking at it now, it's blatantly obvious, and I could definitely see where that would be distracting. As far as the faces go, this artist has a habit of doing a lot of lines on faces and stuff, kind of a little over-rendering in a few places. I didn't have huge problems with the art, but I also didn't think it was all that great. I didn't think all the faces were grimacing and all that kind of a stuff. But there were a few, like, you know, with the double-page splash at the beginning, where, like, with She-Hulk, it's like, okay, that one's really bad. There are a few places where it was just overdone enough that I think that set the stage for you to...
Let's put it this way. I mean, just being in character with characters, Magneto usually has a pretty cool head about things, you know, when he's not,
yeah,
like, pushed
and
into
that's
a
fair.
High stress. And so, like, if you look at the page right before where they show the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah.
In the upper right corner. I mean, this, like, really broad, open mouth, wide eye thing on Magneto, that is not in character for typically Magneto. When you go back a couple of pages from that, right before the t-shirts ad, the bottom panel there, where you got Vision, like, with this giant curled lip sneer kind of expression on his face. Vision typically is relatively emotionless, and having, you know, this
well,
kind
case,
of broad...
A case could be made here that, you know, these guys are both talking about the Scarlet Witch, which was, you know, the Vision's wife, Magneto's daughter. This is a very sore point for them and a very emotional issue. So while I do agree that the faces are kind of over-expressive for these characters, that may have been the point they were trying to make here. Whether it's a good one to do or not,
right?
And I question. I mean,
then, yeah. So we go back to that then. You know, so if it's done on purpose, then I go into the writing. You know, if Bendis has intended for them to have this broad overreaction that's really done in this kind of fashion, then that illustrates the problem that I've had with Bendis's Marvel writing of late.
This is a case where it would be interesting to see what was on the script versus what landed on the art page to get an idea of where some of this came in. Was it the writing? Was it the art? Was it a combination thereof? Because I agree that that was something that, particularly with Magneto, he seemed to be overreacting, and I think some of it with the Vision was more on the writing side, particularly where he's trying to be sarcastic and a few things like that. That just felt out of character. But I think it's also entirely possible that Brian Michael Bendis just doesn't know how to handle the Vision, which is part of why one of the first things he did was get him off stage.
Yeah. In any event, I mean, it wasn't a terrible issue, but it in no way made me want to pick up more issues. So I'll give it a 3.
I can understand that. To me, it was also a 3. It was one that was, it was okay, but it didn't do a good enough job basically reestablishing the Vision, in my opinion.
It continues Marvel's almost complete failure pattern with me on point one issues that I pick up, which, you know, again, back to the original intent, they're supposed to be jumping on issues that compel people to want to read more of that particular series. And I have, in general, out of the 10 or 15 that I have picked up, maybe one time felt compelled to go on and read the issue, which is not a good track record.
Yeah, but I think that's as much a reflection on how Marvel right now is just generally not clicking with you as much as anything else. Not to say that the point one issues are brilliantly done, because for the most part I agree they're not. But I think even if they had been, they would have been jumping on stories, points to stories you wouldn't have been interested in anyways.
Oh, well, sure. What was this like supposed to be getting me to buy?
Avengers, I'm thinking, I guess? Avengers and Avengers versus X-Men.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, 25 goes into that whole storyline. So, again, to me, the fact that it had the Avengers, it had the X-Men and all that kind of stuff, it's, you know, it's paving the road for the zero issue of Avengers versus X-Men that had already come out, which, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how well the Avengers versus X-Men stuff goes over in general. I mean, the first issue and the zero issue, top sellers in March. I already know that. But what I'm not seeing is any kind of a lift on the Avengers or necessarily even the X-Men franchises as a result. So I think this is a potentially pivotal event for Marvel, because right now they're not really clicking with a lot of readers, and they need to turn that around somehow.
Yep. Well, I'm sure you will keep us all, keep me informed if I need to start buying something from Marvel.
I will endeavor to do that.
I mean, you know kind of what I like. So, I mean, you read everything that Marvel does. So, if you read something and say, you know, this is something that Bob will like, I'll give it a try. You know, just keep me in mind and I'll try out. And I'm open to trying the issues, but, you know, they just haven't been clicking.
Yeah, and again, I can understand that. The fact that, you know, the Avengers, the top-selling book over at Marvel, I'd have to look it up which one it was. Again, it was under, I think it was Uncanny X-Men, under 60,000 in February. So there are a lot of things not clicking with a lot of people right now from Marvel. I don't think creatively Marvel's hitting their stride. They seem to be a little off pace, and again, we'll see when they can get that turned around. Shall we move over to our other book of the week?
Indeed. Atomic Robo, Real Science Adventures.
This is the first of the new ongoing monthly Atomic Robo title. Now, the series of miniseries will continue. As a matter of fact, in the current previews, they solicit not only another issue of this, but the first issue of another miniseries. So this is giving the writer, Brian Clevenger, a chance to sell, you know, kind of shorter stories with a number of different artists and just, you know, different characters in the supporting cast and whatnot. So I think it's a great idea. And, you know, Atomic Robo and the Ghost of Station X has been nominated for an Eisner in the Best Limited Series category, and I think it certainly deserves that. I mean, Atomic Robo is a great property, and I think more people should be checking it out. This issue was no exception.
Yeah, I love this issue. I wasn't exactly expecting it to be as many very short stories as we got here, but it worked pretty well for me. I think seeing the different, you know, the vast number of different creative takes on the stories was kind of, I liked it. And, you know, that we're setting up some continuing story in here with the Bruce Lee one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to see that the Dr. Dinosaur one was amusing.
Well, and the Sparrow one's going to continue.
Yeah, the Sparrow one's going to continue also. So,
I mean, the Sparrow one I thought was a really good start to the issue. It really kind of illustrated the tone and style of Atomic Robo, I mean, even though he isn't in the story. And then the Dr. Dinosaur also kind of followed it up with a fun classic, you know, kind of Atomic Robo material. Third one fell a little flat for me. The fourth one looks like a lot of fun. That was the Bruce Lee one. That's the sort of thing that kind of makes me wish they'd spend an entire issue on a single story like that. But I think in the long term, the approach they're taking of the different short stories, kind of like the Marvel Comics Presents format, where they can rotate them in and out, will give it enough narrative threads from issue to issue to kind of keep people hooked. But again, there were a couple, it's like, well, give me a little bit more of that now. It left me wanting in the right ways. The final story was okay, but it felt a little out of place since it was black and white and the rest were all in color.
I had the exact same feeling about that one. I liked it, but it should have been in color.
At first, I wasn't too keen on the let's do that chapter page thing. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought that was a really smart move, because it gave it a visual break and a page flip as we transitioned from artist to artist.
Yeah.
And the different art styles were similar enough that none of them felt out of place. But I think potentially if you'd put one or two of them, you know, right on facing pages, they might have. So overall, I was really impressed with this. Felt it was a lot of fun. I mean, we've said it before. We'll say it again. Go read Atomic Robo.
Yeah. I like the robot one. I mean, the extra robot, the one by Chris Houghton, mm-hmm. City of Skulls. I like that one. I think that the only thing I would have done differently about this issue, other than the color on the last story, would have been I potentially would not have put that Sparrow story first because it didn't feature Robo. And coming straight into the issue with a story that doesn't have Robo, I would have put one of the other stories, like maybe flipped the position with that one and the Bruce Lee one.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Or just bounce the Bruce Lee one forward. So you've got Atomic Robo, Sparrow, the Dr. Dinosaur one, which has Atomic Robo, and then the other two.
Yeah.
So I can see that.
And I can see wanting to start it with the continuing story, which is why I'd say maybe just flip the position between Sparrow and Bruce Lee. But, you know, overall, very solid issue, above average. I mean, 4 out of 5 for me. I really liked it.
Yeah, I gave it the 4 out of 5, strong 4 out of 5. The black and white aspect of that last story and the fact that two of them were just okay. None of the Atomic Robo stuff is ever bad. But I think if those two had clicked a little bit better with me, this easily would have been a 5 out of 5. Atomic Robo, great stuff, highly recommended.
Yeah. Okay, did you read some other stuff this week?
I have read my entire stack. Did that early in the week. Nothing, I mean, it was all good. Nothing really jumps out saying, oh my god, I've got to talk about this. You know, we're getting close to the end of the 12. We got another issue on that. Getting close to the end of Batman Odyssey. Got another issue of that coming out. Those are going to be interesting to see how they wrap all that stuff up. Yeah, a lot of it was just, you know, again, 7th issues of the new 52 stuff. Some more, you know, Marvel stuff. A couple of indies. I had a total of somewhere around 40 or so comics. A little over, I think. So, all good, but nothing that really made me think, wow, I've gotta mention this. Nothing stood out like, you know, Smoke and Mirrors did last week.
Yeah. The one that stood out for me wasn't an actual comic. It was the Gone to America original graphic novel by Colleen Duran, or Derek McCullough writing Colleen Duran art. This I had been keeping my eye out for because I interviewed those guys way back when. This was very well done. Art by Colleen was spectacular. The story was engaging. I really recommend people, if you can take a look at this in the comic shop, to give this one a glance.
Cool. So I guess the only other thing I've got is I want to thank Ruperto Lawson, and I apologize if I've mispronounced your name, for his generous donation of $50. We've got a donation link on the front page of the website. We don't really mention it much. Bob and I do this podcast because we enjoy comics. We enjoy talking about comics. We are a completely unsponsored podcast, and we do that to where we're free to say whatever we want and have it be taken as just what we're saying, not, well, they've been bought or anything remotely of the sort. We just wanted that off the table. So when we get an unsolicited donation like that, it's really appreciated. That helps keep the podcast going, both in terms of the financial sense, but, I mean, to me, it's more the matter of, hey, somebody actually values what we're doing enough that they'd be willing to kick out a couple of bucks for it. You know, we're not making any money on this. We're spending a ton on you know, obviously on the comics, which frankly I think we do anyways. Let's not kid ourselves. But just getting the positive feedback and stuff, always appreciated. So thanks.
You host the website and all that, you know, that you have monthly fees and everything associated with that, which I know you would do anyway, but, you know, just keeping the website for the forum and, you know, for the podcast hosting and all that up is something that you do. And that is an actual out of pocket expense for you. So it's always nice when someone kicks in a donation like that to help out.
Yeah, it does offset some of the actual hard costs of the comic or the podcast, which, you know, it's again, the hosting, the domain name, you know, we keep this pretty much as close to a zero budget kind of an affair as we can, but there are some occasional costs that are always helped to have offset by donations like that. So much appreciated. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
Does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Action Comics number 8 from DC, Avengers vs. X-Men number 1 from Marvel, Danger Club number 1 from Image, and Fanboys vs. Zombies number 1 from Boom Studios.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.